which is shackled against the court of the Cook County Circuit Court. Do we have Ms. Cheney here?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Mr. Hayes?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Ms. Cheney, you have the floor.
All right. Good morning. Thank you for being here today, and may it please the court. Nicole Cheney, Chief Legal Counsel for Teamsters Local 700. The district court the appellate court expressly ordered the parties in this case to address the question of whether the union has the right to appeal. So that inquiry is going to guide the direction of my principal argument here today. To be clear, irrespective of whether the union has the right to appeal, the result is still the same. The district court order has to be vacated and or reversed. First, if the court determines that the union does not have the right to appeal, the district court order must still be vacated because it was entered without subject matter jurisdiction. And appellate jurisdiction is proper for, at the very least, the limited purpose of reviewing and correcting that error. And
we would have to have appellate jurisdiction to review that error. But let me ask you, kind of cut to the chase on the appellate jurisdiction point.
Sure.
You don't, which line of cases that permit a non-party below to appeal do you think you are most closely analogous to? I was kind of surprised. In your 28J letter, you seem to be saying that you fit into cases that would characterize you as representing the plaintiff members of the class. Did I misunderstand what your letter was getting at?
No, so that is, in summary, one basis for determining that we are a party with the right, or excuse me, not a party, but that we have a right to appeal as a non-party. And the analysis behind that kind of delves into the novelty of this case. Despite the best efforts of the opposing counsel to avoid the issue, the Shackman appellees were the movement in this case. They tried to fast track their desire to have the CA monitor the grievance procedure by filing a motion for declaratory relief in an underlying lawsuit. Now, they made the choice to seek relief against a non-party in that lawsuit. In their filing of the supplemental authority, they claimed that the union is similarly situated to the non-party appellant in the Douglas case. And we responded in kind by filing supplemental authority, specifically the Reynolds and the TransUnion cases. And those underscore our right to appeal. The Douglas case is distinguishable from us factually. In that case, the appellant whose appeal was ultimately dismissed was not a class member. The district court concluded that she was not a class member, and she did not appeal that ruling.
Right, but you're not a class member. Let me return to where you started.
Sure.
When you said that, yes, you do represent some of the plaintiffs in the class. Of the union, but they're already represented by the named class representatives and by class counsel.
In that lawsuit, our representation of them is under state law.
If they objected to the declaratory judgment respecting the supplemental relief order, they could have said so. And in fact, it was the plaintiff's class, as you point out, who moved for it.
That's correct. But the supplemental relief order does not in any form or fashion address the grievance procedure or the collective bargaining agreement between us and the clerk's office. That is an entirely separate right that the class members have outside of the underlying litigation. The litigation in which this case's SRO was established involves political patronage allegations against the clerk's office. We are content to allow the class representatives to litigate that case, to enter into supplemental relief orders in whatever way necessary, so long as it doesn't infringe upon our rights to represent the class members in their labor interests under the Labor Act against the clerk's office. So in essence, the reason why we are, or the reason why I've argued that we are more akin to the Reynolds and TransUnion cases as distinguished from the Douglas cases is because the Douglas court pointed to those cases as examples of prior instances in which the court has allowed non-parties to appeal when those non-parties were agents of the class members who were trying to address separate issues. So for example, in the Reynolds case, they were attorneys of the class members who had tried to intervene and whose intervention attempts were denied. And TransUnion, yes.
Ms. Payne, can I follow up on this a little bit?
Sure.
It's not at all unusual for injunctions to affect the interests of people who are not parties to a lawsuit. That's in essence factor four in issuing a preliminary injunction, consequences for non-parties. Procedurally, there's a pretty well-established path for people who believe they are adversely affected by an injunction to be heard, and that's to intervene. And then denial of intervention is appealable. An intervener has appellate rights. Why do we need to create some kind of special rule here?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, the prospect of intervention would be a sort of an end around to federal question. It's our position that there is not a federal question.
That's no different from somebody who says this injunction is causing, let's say, a party I have a contract with to breach my contract. I've got a state law claim for breach of contract, but Judge, you're messing up our business and our life here. We need to be heard.
Certainly, and I understand what you're saying. There have been instances in the past in which we have utilized intervention to address issues. For example, in the Doe case, we intervened in the Doe case in the district court, but that was because the order that the parties were, the consent decree that they were entering into resulted in a, or was anticipated to result in a reorganization and a termination of a couple hundred of our bargaining unit members. And so we intervened assert those rights, because the SRO had no indication that it was going to affect the grievance procedure or implicate any of the union's rights under the collective bargaining agreement or anything of that nature.
Counsel, you took the declaratory judgment action because you appeared in the district court and were heard on it, but you didn't move to
right.
Why? It's not like it caught you by surprise. You knew that the declaratory judgment had been sought.
We did. We did know that the declaratory judgment had been sought. But we also knew that the state law rights, as we believe, the state law rights are entirely distinct from the SRO. The SRO didn't say anything about monitoring the grievance procedure, and this case has been going on for decades.
You made the same merits arguments that you're making to us now in the district court, but you didn't intervene, and it feels a little like you're trying to have your cake and eat it too, because you don't want to be a party in the district court, because that's part of your challenge to the district court's order. You say it can't bind you as a non-party, but you want us to treat you like a party for purposes of the appeal.
Your Honor, respectfully, we would prefer to have sort of a laissez-faire approach here, allow the Shackson litigants to continue on with their case and allow us to continue on with our contractual relationship with the clerk. There's no demonstration or connection at all made suggesting that there was any efforts for the clerk to utilize its relationship with us to engage in political patronage, that there was any instances of political patronage in the grievance procedure. And it sort of redefines the Labor Act to allow a third party to come into grievance proceedings when that bill is identified under the state act.
You're well into your rebuttal at this point, but I hope you would identify where you think having this observer present violates state law.
Sure. The state law mandates the grievance procedure, and in exchange for that, the employees have to give up their right to strike. That's part of ensuring that there's labor peace.
I understand that. What I kept looking for in your brief was some specific indication of state law prohibiting the presence of an observer for any purposes, let alone these.
Well, surely I wouldn't say that it's expressly identified in the state law that third parties are excluded. However, it does contemplate relationships between the parties to the contract, and any change in or modification to the party's contract or the party's relationship is something that has to be negotiated. So the district court's order, in effect, modifies the union and the clerk's relationship and their ability to make the determination about who is or is not allowed to be part of the grievance process.
Okay. If there are no further questions, you're over time, but you'll have a brief opportunity for rebuttal. Thank you very much, Ms. Bailey. Mr. Hayes?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Brian Hayes. I represent the plaintiff classes in this case. And the lower court's decision should be affirmed. As the court was just discussing, the union has not identified any rights that are at stake in the Shacklin litigation. They haven't identified any section of the statute that has been violated, nor have they identified any section of the collective bargaining agreement that would be violated by having a court-appointed monitor attend and observe, strictly observe, the grievance procedures. And the union should not be allowed to obstruct the district court's special master, called in this case a compliance administrator. And because doing so would undermine the party's negotiated supplemental relief order, and it would also threaten to prolong federal court oversight of the clerk's employment practices. The supplemental relief order that we're talking about today is one of a number of similar decrees and orders that have been entered in this case since 2005, designed to bring all of the defendants, like the clerk, into compliance with the existing Shacklin decrees so that federal court oversight can end. The most important part of the supplemental relief order is the use of these independent compliance administrators, and they're appointed by the court. They report to the district court about whether the defendants are making good on their promises to eliminate unlawful political discrimination. Now, this process has been successful for other defendants like the City of Chicago, Cook County, Cook County Sheriff's Office, and others. And the union shouldn't be allowed to hinder the compliance administrator's passive monitoring of grievance procedures.
Mr. Hayes, do you all see the union as engaged in or abetting ongoing violations of federal law through this process?
Well, we do not, Your Honor, but that's not a requirement for having a court-appointed monitor. The focus
of
the monitor.
Why is this? My basic question is, why is this such a big deal, and why are you and the union having such a big fight about it?
Mm-hmm. I agree, Your Honor. It should not be a big deal, and there should not be a fight over this. There have been court-appointed monitors that monitored grievance procedures at the city, at the county. They're doing so at the state level. They're doing so at the assessor's office, at the Cook County Recorder of Deeds office, and there's never been any issue, never been any problems. There's never been any violation of confidentiality provisions, anything like that. In fact, since Judge Schenker entered this order, the compliance administrator has monitored a number of union grievances at the clerk of the circuit court's office without any issues or any problems whatsoever. And what's important here and why we filed this motion is that this case is about, as you know, unlawful political discrimination. And that includes, you know, not just hiring people or firing people. It also includes taking adverse actions in order to coerce employees into making political donations. And so observing and monitoring and reporting to the court on these grievance procedures is a part of that, to make sure that the clerk's office is not engaged, not the union, but to make sure that the clerk's office is not engaged in unlawful political discrimination in the grievance process. And our hope is that the monitor will be there and will report that there is, in fact, no evidence of unlawful political discrimination, so that the compliance administrator can report to the court in the coming months or years, however long it may take, but to say that the clerk's office is in compliance with the court orders and the federal court oversight is no longer necessary. And part of that will be to ensure that there's no political reporting, that there's no political discrimination in the context of disciplinary proceedings.
I would intervene here. Is the whole objective of this compliance administrator to see if people, in order to get a job, have to make a political contribution? Or is there something more when you talk about what is political? I don't know enough about, say, Chicago, but under the circumstances there, there's always a lot of people talking about you get a job there, but you got to work for somebody, and I guess that's the political stuff, because I was just curious about this. A long time ago when I was working in Indiana, they had a thing they called, you would actually have to pay money and get permission from a county chairman to show that you were in the right political party in order to work someplace. Is it that open and obvious, or is it just a matter of somebody said that they were forced to make a political contribution? What's this compliance person there for? What's he or she to do?
Sure. So in the present case, the compliance administrator was appointed after the U.S. Attorney's Office issued some indictments and actually obtained a conviction for lying to the grand jury. The allegations there and the evidence showed that the clerk's office was exchanging jobs, selling jobs to individuals who had made political donations to her campaign. There have also been allegations over the years about the clerk's office requiring employees to make contributions to a political campaign, that monies that were donated for Friday Jeans Days went to her political campaign, things like that. So it's both, in this case, the allegations, and there was evidence supporting that both people who were applying for jobs at the clerk's office were discriminated against based on whether or not they had made donations to her campaign, but there was also evidence that existing employees, current employees, were being coerced to make campaign contributions. Now, in this case, the clerk's office, confronted with that evidence, entered into a settlement with a supplemental relief order. So we did not go forward with discovery and find out the full extent of everything that was being done. That's part of what the compliance administrator is tasked with doing. She's tasked with going out and investigating the employment practices of the office, and that includes not just hiring and firing, but also transfers, reassignments, overtime, and discipline, to make sure that the office has rooted out the historical political patronage and has implemented policies and procedures so that it's unlikely that political patronage will come back after the court sunsets the decrees.
Does the compliance officer present some kind of a finding or the periodical report of what's going on?
Yes, Your Honor. The compliance administrator is to, I believe, it's quarterly reports are filed with the court. And then for the sunset procedure, that when the clerk's office believes that it is in compliance with the decrees, they would file a motion to terminate. The compliance administrator would then file a report with the court saying, yes, I'm in agreement and here's why, or saying, no, I don't think the office is ready for substantial compliance or for sunset for these reasons. And that would be part of the court's consideration in deciding whether or not to terminate the decree under Rule 60B.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Could I ask you, Mr. Hayes, I understand your position that there's no appellate jurisdiction at this point. But suppose the union said, if we dismiss this appeal, the union goes back and notifies the district court that we respectfully disagree with your order. We are not a party to this case or to the SRO. We don't think you have the power to do this or grounds to hold us in contempt. So with all due respect, we're not going to allow the compliance officer in. And the district judge respectfully holds them in contempt, imposes sanctions and stays them pending appeal. We're right back here on the merits of these claims, right?
Well, that's certainly a potential, Your Honor, but I would hope that it would not come to that. But I think what's important for this court to consider is that those decisions about holding the union in contempt and what, if any, sanction is appropriate should be made in the first instance by the trial court and not by this court. And so these procedures do matter, and as the court raised, there is no reason to create some special rule in this case. There is a process for the union to either file a motion to intervene, although I don't believe it would be successful, or to, you know, resist and be held in contempt and then have the matter come up when this court does in fact have appellate jurisdiction.
Why do you think intervention would be unsuccessful given the effect the order has on them?
Because the order doesn't really have any effect on them, Your Honor. As you pointed out at the end in the argument, the union is not able to cite to a single provision in the Illinois statutes that's being violated. They can't cite to a single collective bargaining agreement.
Well, it doesn't necessarily have to be an intrusion upon a legal interest, but just to say, look, we have a well-established process. It's confidential, and it's important to us. This is disrupting our procedure. We would like to be heard.
Well, they would need to make those allegations and present facts in support of that in order to intervene. Yeah. And in this case, as I said, we have a long history of compliance administrators monitoring disciplinary grievance meetings without any interference. You know, this is not a case like in Doe. The compliance administrator is not a receiver. She's not taking over these employment actions and making the decisions. She's strictly monitoring them and reporting. And in fact, under the collective bargaining agreement, the employees don't have to have the union represent them. The employee can file their own grievance and represent themselves or have somebody else represent them, you know, counsel. And in that case, the union is the passive observer monitoring what's happening in the grievance procedure to make sure that their collective bargaining agreement isn't violated. Well, here we have a passive observer
making sure
the court order. Thank you,
Your
Honor.
You have a minute left.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. And so in this case, we have, like the union, when an employee decides to do their own grievance, here we strictly have a court-appointed monitor passively observing what's going on to report to the court to make sure that the court's orders are not violated. And that is well within the discretion of the trial court here after making the necessary findings. And as I said, this is the compliance administrator observing the employment actions to make sure that unlawful political discrimination is not occurring and is unlikely to reoccur after sunset is an important and vital part of this case and bringing it to its final conclusion, just as we have with the city of Chicago and Cook County and others. And so we would ask that the lower court's order be affirmed and allowed to stand. And thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much. Ms. Cheney, as I said, your time had expired, but if you need a moment or two for rebuttal, you may have it. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you very much. I'm going to try to be as quick as I can. First, I do want to address opposing counsel's contention that an employee can file a grievance on their own and take it up with a representative other than the union. That is actually incorrect. The employee can file it at the first step. They are not permitted to have independent representation from another attorney in that process. To the point that the compliance administrator is passive, that is actually also factually inaccurate. The compliance administrator's report recommended things to the clerk's office in how the clerk responded to us about the grievance process. The reason why this is such a big deal is because as a union, we have non-lawyers who assist in representing folks at grievance procedures. It is intended to be an informal process because they work through the ranks and work between the rank and file and the labor management relationships. We also have members who have expressed some concern about having the CA present, and the CA actually noted that in her quarterly report. To the point about negotiating the SRO, the clerk and the Shackman appellees negotiated the SRO only after the clerk negotiated a contract with us. We've had a relationship with them for years. So they negotiated one contract and then turned around and negotiated a second contract that allowed the Shackman appellees and the clerk to appoint the CA and purportedly to allow the CA to attend grievance procedures, although the SRO does not state that in any of its provisions. It does not state that the CA will be monitoring grievance procedures.
I think we understand that. You need to wrap up. Okay.
Sure. All right. Thank you very much. To the point about the motion to intervene would be not likely to be successful, I think that's a pretty compelling point, and I would also direct the court or request that the court refer back to the TransUnion Corp privacy litigation case in which the lawyer in that case did not seek to intervene and specifically chose not to, but was still permitted to appeal for purposes of the litigation. And that, I think I could probably go on, but I respectfully understand that my time is up. So thank you very much.
All right, our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. That concludes the matters for today, and the court will be in recess. And thanks again to all counsel.